Vaccine shortfall will not delay plans for reopening, is the lead headline for the Irish Times this morning, above detail that significant shortfalls in supply are not expected to affect the new schedule for reopening of social and economic life to be announced today. And there's plenty of detail on what's expected to be announced later in the papers this morning. Matches, concerts and outdoor gigs from June 7th is the main story for the Irish Examiner, which says that in a surprise move, NPHET has recommended that some measures be eased earlier than expected, allowing for the resumption of outdoor events for up to 100 people or 200 in larger stadia from the first week in June. And we're told cinemas have also been added to the June 7th reopening list. Today's expected announcement on indoor dining is flagged on the front of the Irish Daily Star, and the Irish Daily Mail's front page declares summer kicks off and lists off the top line details of what's flagged to be announced. Reopening is on the front page of the Irish Independent too this morning, and that paper's editorial takes into account the latest news on the vaccine shortfalls and the expected relaxation of restrictions, writing that opposition frontbenchers and coalition backbenchers alike have the luxury of forgetting everything they've said before and coming out with top-of-the-head theories. The leader writer concludes that the Cabinet would be well advised to err on the side of caution. It would be better to be conservative than to be caught out again. Elsewhere on the front page of the Irish Times, Mark Paul has the story that hair salons say the pandemic unemployment payment and black market nixers for hairdressing are causing a staffing crisis, and that the Hairdressing Council of Ireland wants action on what it characterises as the shadow economy. He gives the example of the Dublin hair salon chain Lambre, which says it's had to turn away up to 40% of customers. The ratification of Edwin Poots as leader of the DUP is big news for the Belfast Telegraph and the Irish News this morning. The two papers report that outgoing leader Arlene Foster and leadership rival Geoffrey Donaldson both left last night's confirmation meeting before the new leader addressed his party, with Gareth Cross reporting in the Telegraph that Mrs. Foster made a peace sign as she departed. And elsewhere on the Irish News front page, the story that the TV doctor Christian Jessen is facing a legal bill in excess of £250,000 over his libelous claim that Arlene Foster had an extramarital affair. Yesterday, she was awarded damages of £125,000 by the High Court in Belfast over the defamatory tweet. And in the comment pages of The Independent, John Connell writes about his recent trip to Newgrange in County Meath. He writes that in looking at these ancient monuments, I can see the shared work produced something that has remained forever. We are all in this business of working the metal of the spirit now. In this, the hopeful ending of COVID, we have all been making a better Ireland in our own small ways, from the nurse to the schoolteacher. Maybe Newgrange isn't a structure, it's a feeling.
Well, Public Expenditure Minister Michael McGrath said the country is in a really good place ahead of today's announcement on the reopening plan when he was on primetime last night. And as you heard in the bulletin this morning and in the paper's review, a lot of the detail is emerging about what you can look forward to. For more, we're joined by our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan. Micheál, it'll all be set out for us at 6 o'clock tonight. Take us through what we're likely to hear.
Yeah, well, things begin to change from June 2nd. It is at that point that hotels and guest houses reopen. And then on the 7th of June, even more significant changes. That's when outdoor dining and drinking can resume. Cinemas can also reopen from that date, and gyms as well. And then weddings in June rise to 25 people. And then moving on to July, it's from July 5th that things begin to change. And some surprise, I think, at that meeting last night that the way was cleared on that date, perhaps a little bit earlier than maybe ministers had anticipated, July 5th, the date on which indoor hospitality, pubs and restaurants being able to serve indoors from that point on. Also around that time, the indoor possibilities come back into view that you could see in smaller venues, 50 people meeting indoors and perhaps up to 100 in larger ones. And then in the outdoor context in July, it's between 200 and 500 people at bigger outdoor venues, particularly sports ones, would be able to meet up. So that's the big change in July. And in weddings, when it comes to weddings in July, they rise up to 50 before going to 100 in August. August 2, there are significant changes in the sense of the amount of people that might be able to go into a sports stadium in particular. That could rise up to 5,000 in bigger venues. I think you are perhaps over the course of the day going to see more detail in relation to sports attendances and possible ones that could be used for piloting perhaps initially through maybe June and July, and also in relation to entertainment and music gigs. More detail likely to be provided on what's possible through the summer on that in exact terms.
Was there some surprise in political circles about NPHET appearing to take a relatively benign view about reopening despite the dark cloud of the Indian variant, the shortfall in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Yeah, I think what you can see from the fact that the meeting was about 3 hours in the end, a large part of that, the early part, running from 7:30 up beyond 9 o'clock, was in relation to that public health advice. And I think there was a lot of questions asked about what are the risks involved, and perhaps a little surprise, particularly around the indoor hospitality, that could move on the 5th of July. A big discussion too when it came to international travel. And I think that went over and back for quite some time as to whether or not it will be the 26th of July before the Taoiseach and ministers at that meeting agreed that it would be on the 19th of July. So on that point, you can see international travel returning and Ireland becoming part of the European Green Digital Cert. And of course, that opening the way then for international travel if people meet the criteria of being vaccinated or having recovered from COVID-19 or else having a test. And to pave the way for that, you're likely to see today that the EU countries on the mandatory hotel quarantine list, Luxembourg, France and Belgium, would be removed very swiftly indeed. And of course, while you do see an extension of mandatory hotel quarantine, a proposal going through the Dáil to bring it to the end of July, it does seem that it may, after the July the 19th, be largely used. They will obviously be red zone countries as well, but largely used for people who don't meet that criteria and not having a test or not having a vaccination arriving into the country.
The aviation sector has been highly critical of the government and the lockdown policies. They say they want a plan. Will they get that with the announcement today, the 19th of July being one date I'm sure will be welcome, but will that be enough? Will there be more on aviation?
I think the 19th of July seems to be the date. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any distinction drawn between the common travel area and wider international travel beyond that. Of course, there was a push for that to move earlier on that because that makes up about a third of the aviation traffic when it comes in and out of the country. But it doesn't seem so. I think there is a view that more time is needed, all right, perhaps beyond those early days of July when the EU system gets up and running to get things ready here, that it is going to require a fairly comprehensive piece of planning, particularly around what documents will be inspected and what is needed at the ports and airports. I think there is also a view and a hope within government that if you look between now and then, there is a possibility that more than 2 million more vaccine doses will be administered at that point between now and then.
We'll be getting, of course, the economic plan next week. The Cabinet still to finalise the details on that. The hospitality sector will be looking keenly at that. Many employers will be looking keenly at PUP rates. They say they're having difficulty getting workers back. Hospitality not happy about no indoor dining till the 5th or the 7th. There's even talk of legal action, is there?
There is talk of legal action, and that is that central point that has been spoken about, and that's something that was prominent when the political parties met in Dublin during the week, and that focuses particularly on the fact that hotels will be able to serve people indoors from the 2nd of June, while that indoor service for the other parts of the hospitality sector has to wait until July 5th. The Restaurants Association saying that no scientific basis has been established for that. So as soon as the statutory instrument, which essentially will give effect to hotels being able to serve indoors very soon now, as soon as that is signed, they are going to mount a legal challenge.
All right, Micheál Aghan, political correspondent, thank you.
And now let's get some opposition reaction to what we're hearing there from Micheál. Éan Ó-Riordan is Labour Party TD for Dublin Bay North and the party's spokesman on education. Éan Ó-Riordan, a fairly comprehensive outline there from Micheál Aghan on what we expect from an Taoiseach later on today. What's your reaction to what you're hearing?
Oh, I think we need to be positive, and I think we need to be optimistic. And as long as all of this is within public health guidelines and NPHET advice, which it appears to be, I think collectively as a country we need to maybe take a breath and be positive. We've gone through some very, very dark months over the last period of time. You remember January, which is only a few short months ago, when schools were closed, when childcare facilities were closed, when care homes weren't able to have visits, when we had a case rate and a death rate in January which was higher than the entire of 2020. So the opening up in December obviously didn't work. This is much more cautious, much more phased, and something that I think everybody in the country needs to hear the political system, government and opposition speaking with a level of positivity. Obviously, there are things that we need to be, watching out for: PUP payments, supports for businesses, issues around rent, and certainly, outstanding issues relating to maternity hospitals and visits. But I think, as a country, we've been through so much, and there's been so much heartbreak over the last, year and more, that today I think we need to be able to look forward.
Okay, and we'll talk about some of those issues you raised there about the supports for people and for businesses. But as Micheál outlined it, we have that the hospitality sector being given its dates and timelines, the entertainment industry being given dates and timelines as well for opening up both indoor and outdoor, and international travel, the date Micheál is telling us from the 19th of July. You talked about caution. Is there caution within that plan and within the rollout of that plan?
Well, ever since the beginning of the year, when mistakes were clearly made in December, and things happened too fast, and then we had a very, very dark January. We have said since then, in dealing with government and in our public comments, that we needed to follow public health advice and that we needed to listen to every single word that NPHET had said. And I think we've done that successfully as a political collective over the last period of time. And if these measures, as outlined, have that backing, have that advice, we're following public health advice, but then, that caution, that phased approach is something that we have to support. Obviously, there is an impatience within society to get back to some level of normality, but we are still dealing with variants that we're still assessing as to where they are, as to how potent they are, as to how the vaccination schedule can actually deal with them. But in a general way, Mary, I think we have to just think back to the level of heartbreak we've been through, the level of restrictions that we had to go through, the times when our schools were closed, the times when we couldn't embrace our loved ones. And I think there will always be time for criticism in political circles. There'll always be time for point scoring. But on a day like today, I think, as a country, as a nation, we can allow ourselves a little bit of optimism, and also the fact that we need to be absolutely clear that this is following public health advice.
Now, the National Economic Recovery Plan to be announced next Tuesday, we're given to believe that there will be, well, we've been told by government, no cliff edge with the supports that are there, but there will be a phasing out towards the fourth quarter. Do you accept that the supports that have been there for business and the supports that have been there for individuals who were out of work during this pandemic, that the time will have come by September, October, where these supports must be phased back and phased out?
Well, look, we believe that the PUP may be needed into the autumn and possibly until the end of the year. We don't believe we should have a hard date or a cliff edge, as you've described it, because we've had those hard dates before and government have had to extend them. Remember, people on the PUP payment have all been working before, so they're all anxious to get back to work. And we reject this sort of idea that people will be intent on keeping a payment which is potentially, larger than what they earned before.
I think, and employers worries that the PUP payment may be keeping employees away from the workforce,
we've
encouraging them not to go back.
We've heard all that before. We've heard that in terms of minimum wage arguments, which haven't stood up to any sort of analysis. In terms of business supports, though, like the EWSS and CRIS, which we believe need to be kept in place as needed. Some businesses may not be able to reopen fully or properly for some time. And we'd also like to see the EWSS turned into a permanent short-term working scheme with training based on the German model. So, look, we can work with business. And we can ensure that there is, a gradual return to what has been described as normal. But I would also say this much, Mary, if I might.
I am really out of time, Eoghan,
in terms of many workers going back to what is normality, we did have a very low pay economy before the pandemic. 23% of Irish workers were in low pay, and a huge number of young people in insecure work. That has to come into the thinking when government.
All right, Labour Party spokesman Eoghan O'Riordan, thank you.
New DUP leader Edwin Poots launched quite a broadside against Fine Gael, especially Tánaiste Leo Varadkar and Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney, after he was formally ratified as leader last night. Here are some of his remarks to reporters, including our own Laura Hogan, who asked him about plans to meet the Taoiseach. And here's what Edwin Poots said.
Have you made contact with the Irish government yet, and do you have any plans to travel to Dublin to meet with the Taoiseach?
Well, we'll be making contact with the Irish government. I wasn't leader until tomorrow, so those things will flow from that. I would say that I have respect for Micheál Martin, but I'd have to say that for Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, who took photographs of blown up border posts to impose upon Northern Ireland people a harshest form of customs and an internal market that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, was quite frankly disgraceful. And they're going to starve Northern Ireland people of medicines, no less, cancer drugs and other materials such as the food that's on our table. And I'd say that's a shame on the Irish government that they've done that. And that belongs to Fine Gael under the leadership of Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney. So relationships are really, really bad with the Irish government as a consequence.
The new DUP leader speaking to our reporter Laura Hogan, amongst others, last night. Joining us now, Alex Kane, a columnist and political commentator. Do you know what he's talking about, Alex?
Well, good morning. Yes, I think the problem for Poots is that when he was elected leader, I think his main plan was to be reasonably conciliatory, reasonably pragmatic, because he doesn't want the Assembly to collapse. I think he knows that dumping the protocol is going to be enormously difficult and will take good relationships with the British government, the Irish government and the EU. But he is so weak now. He made it to the leadership. He needed 19 votes. He got 19 votes. He had a horrible night last night. What was supposed to be a brief ratification followed by lots of speeches and, you know, ideas are going forward, turned into just a marathon, turned into a nightmare. I think you have to go back almost 50 years, Anya, to find a Unionist Party leader who entered office as weak as Poots now is. And the gallery he's decided to play to, and I don't know how long it'll last, but is this, let's attack the Irish government, let's attack, you know, everyone else, because he's trying to rally the party around on the ground. The movement against the protocol is quite strong. The Orange Orders against the protocol. Number of other external forces which could challenge the DUP against the protocol. So Poots is now playing to his hardline base, and I think that is going to be an enormously difficult situation for him to keep going over the next few months.
And the divisions were on show, weren't they? There were walkouts before his speech, is that right?
Oh, look, this is extraordinary. I used to work for the Old Students' Party, so I remember when Geoffrey Donaldson, Arlene Foster and people walked away during the Good Friday negotiations. I remember when they left the party 5 years later and joined the Democratic Unionist Party. And one of the reasons Arlene gave when she joined the DUP, it was a united party, a strong family where there was loyalty across the party. Now the DUP, it's a sort of parallel universe world. The DUP seems to have morphed into the Ulster Unionist Party, where you have divisions which are open. And I think in one sense that was almost inevitable, because for 50 years they didn't have a leadership election. So any splits there were, and there were divisions, were kept in-house. And it was, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. When you have a competition and the leader just about wins, it's very difficult to pretend that you don't have difficulties. I think, yes, again, they're talking about that we are the only party, we are the biggest party. But the two opinion polls in the past couple of weeks have them down at 16% from 30% in December 2019, the general election. They're now registering around 16%. This is nightmare territory. And what makes it, I suppose, fascinating for observers in one sense, the Democratic Unionist Party has never in its entire history, and it'll be 50 in September, it has never, ever been in this territory before. This is all new ground for it.
Final question, Alex Kane. Who's going to be First Minister, given that Edwin Poots says he's not going to take the job?
Well, it looks like his fellow MLA in Lagan Valley, Paul Given, might be given it. But what's emerging, Anya, is that when Poots had a lineup of ministerial colleagues to take their positions over the next, you know, by now, a lot of them seem to be going to ground. A lot of people seem to be backing away because I think they've realised that he has an enormous problem. The party is an enormous problem. And some people who might have been keen to be First Minister may have decided that the hits that they would take in the succeeding few months may not be good for their political careers.
Alex Kane, political columnist and commentator. Thank you for speaking to us on Morning Ireland.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Time to look ahead now to all the weekend sport. Here's Des Cahill.
Yeah, and we can look even further ahead, Mary, with that good news that spectators look set to finally be allowed to return to outdoor sporting events from June the 7th. The word is that initially it'll be 200 spectators, but we hear that the NPHET recommendation is that the number of spectators permitted would rise to 500 in July, and that in early August up to 5,000 people could be able to attend events in big outdoor venues. Those figures are expected to be confirmed later today, yet have to be considered by Cabinet. Now, it'll be an emotional evening at Thomond Park when CJ Stander, Tommy O'Donnell and James Cronin will make their final appearance for their province in the last home game of the season as they take on Cardiff in the Rainbow Cup. Munster's forwards coach Graham Rownsree praised all three players, but he said their departure is part of sport.
That's what happens, isn't it? You evolve, players leave, they pass on their knowledge to the young guys coming through, which that group of players you just mentioned are exceptional at, and we move on. It's just that's how clubs evolve. Three brilliant men, but I can't speak highly enough about them, and in particular the way they share their knowledge with the young guys coming through. So no, I'm happy with the guys coming through to replace them.
Pity there can't be spectators there for that. Now, Ulster's game against Scarlets tomorrow has been cancelled as four Ulster players have tested positive for COVID-19. Meanwhile, the Kilkenny-Wexford Hurling League game has not yet been given the go-ahead for Sunday, but it is expected to be confirmed later today. It was postponed last week because three Wexford players had COVID. Yesterday, Kilkenny reported that one of their players had tested positive, but it's believed that the case arose in a non-team context and officials are confident all further tests will be negative. In soccer, the league leaders Sligo Rovers face a tricky game at Finn Harps this evening. Here's the Sligo manager, Liam Buckley.
It's obvious it's a local derby. There's very little between ourselves and Finn Harps in the games that we've played, so we're expecting another tough game, as there is. All the games are tough in this league, yeah, if you don't turn up. We can look forward to it. We're top of the table. Let's see how it goes. But listen, it is exciting for the group. We've worked hard, and it's a testament to how well we've done. We have worked hard. Our fitness levels are good. So if you can just maintain, if you can just, please God, stay injury-free, we can stay at the top end of the table.
Now, chasing Sligo Rovers are St Patrick's Athletic. They host Dundalk this evening and Drogheda entertain Derry City. In the First Division, the big match sees the leaders Shelburne host Galway United. Now, golf, and Leona Maguire went close to sealing her place in the knockout stages with another strong performance at the LPGA match play in Las Vegas. The Cavan woman led her match with world number 17 Jennifer Kupcho all the way, but the American reeled her in to force a half on the final hole. Both players now have 1.5 points from two games. Maguire faces Christina Kim in the final group match today. Also a good day for Downs' Jonathan Caldwell on the European Tour. A strong finish to his round in Denmark saw him just one shot behind the leaders. On the PGA Tour in America, Jordan Spieth and Sergio Garcia lead the Charles Schwab Challenge on 7 under par. Graham McDowell is 4 over. Nicholas Roach battled bravely to finish third on yesterday's stage of the Giro d'Italia. Italy's Alberto Bettiol took stage honours. The race leader Egan Bernal retains his overall advantage of 2 minutes 21 seconds. Dan Martin is 10th overall. Finally, racing, it was another good day for Henry de Bromhead, who won the Henry II Stakes at Standdown with Lismore and also had a double at Limerick. Today's action is at Ferry House. The first race is off at 1:15.
Transport Minister Eamon Ryan has welcomed the decision of the International Civil Aviation Organisation to launch an investigation into the forced landing of a Ryanair flight in Belarus last Sunday and the arrest of journalist Roman Protasevich. Minister, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You've welcomed it, but what's the significance of this investigation? What can it achieve?
It has to find out exactly what happened. It is disputed. Yesterday, two events took place. We held, and Ireland actually holds the presidency at the moment, so it was useful. The International Transport Forum held a summit, and at that, ourselves and a number of other countries raised, Lithuania, US, UK, Italy, other countries, raised real condemnation for what had happened on Sunday, where a Ryanair flight, as everyone knows, was diverted to Minsk Airport. Two people taken off, the people held there for 6 hours, and then two people taken and who are now imprisoned.
Michael O'Leary says it was aviation piracy. Do you agree?
Yes, there was coercion to bring the plane to ground. And that's a huge worrying escalation in the whole world of civil aviation, because if you're not feel safe in terms of that a plane isn't going to be diverted and effectively overtaken in that way, that will undermine fundamentally the whole confidence in the security of flying.
Yesterday, have you spoken to Michael O'Leary about this, by the way, since last Sunday?
I was speaking to Eddie Wilson yesterday, from the chief executive of Ryanair, so he was able to give me an update from their perspective, and that was very useful. In the afternoon then, what we called for was the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to carry out the formal investigation. And they're the right people to do it. Under the Chicago Convention, which is the international convention that regulates civil aviation, there's an article there, Article 55E, which says they can carry out an independent investigation. So there was a meeting again yesterday afternoon, which I was glad to attend with my Polish and Lithuanian colleagues, are asking for such an investigation. Again, there was a very lengthy debate, and in the end, the council agreed that they would do that. I expected their interim report should be available at the end of June, and it's critical because you can't let this go without consequences.
But Russia and Minsk don't seem to be too worried. I mean, in the week since, we've had French and Austrian flights being refused permission to overfly Russian airspace because they're trying to follow the new EU policy and avoid Belarusian airspace. So it doesn't look as if Russia or Minsk give much of a hoot about what the EU thinks about this at the moment.
Well, that's why the EU at the council meeting earlier in the week said that they were going to be determined to implement effective sanctions. It'll take time for those to take effect, but the EU couldn't have been stronger. But first things first, the International Civil Aviation Organization will have to actually determine the true facts of it. It was disputed by Belarus and Russia in their presentations yesterday. And I think the fact that the ICAO is now investigating it will give us the opportunity to show exactly what happened, to examine all their recordings, to look at the sequence and the timing of the emails and the other warnings that were given. And I think that will then help develop an international response.
Do you think Russia's going to blink on this? I mean, so far it's been escalating with the refusal of some EU flights to use Russian airspace. Do you think it's going to... How is this going to be resolved? By the release of Mr. Protasevich and his girlfriend?
That first, but primarily, as I said, with the finding of the facts and through the international aviation authorities, for them to actually set out what the consequences are in terms of how the Belarusian authorities, what they have to do.
We've seen, you know, Russia kind of tangling with the West, and, you know, there have been various points of tension and conflict over the past number of years. But this, in terms of airspace, is this the politicisation of airspace?
It was the first time, and this is why it's so significant, that an aircraft was diverted in this way. Well, the first time in this manner involving a European aircraft. It was an Irish airline, obviously, a Polish registered plane, Buzz Airlines running the service under Ryanair's auspice, landing in Lithuania. And that's why I think, and it was between two European capitals, and that's why Europe has taken such a strong line against it.
Just Philip Stevens is writing in the Financial Times, which has been going big on this. He's pointing to Russia's annexation of Crimea, the occupation of eastern Ukraine, their support for Bashar al-Assad, the arrest of Alexei Navalny, the meddling in Western allegations, the cyber attacks. Do you really think the threat of EU sanctions is going to turn this around?
Yes, because I think in the end you have to... your neighbours are important. These countries do neighbour. Belarusian neighbours, there are.
So
European.
They need Europe as well as the calculation. All right. I want to talk to you about when we're joining the Digital Green Certificate. You seem to be giving quite a hint yesterday. 19th of July?
It'll have to be decided at Cabinet later on this morning, so I don't want to give the exact date in advance of Cabinet signing off on it, but it's in that sort of time frame that we can expect. And the Europe will introduce the scheme from the 1st of July, but recognising, they said, that there should be about 6 weeks of an introductory period. We will need some of those weeks, because one of the things we're going to have to manage in this, and it will be difficult, will how we manage our airports, because as the numbers of people travelling increase, we will still be requiring people to be able to show that cert. And even though that'll be an electronic and it'll be very brief, it'll only take a short period, it will still
and
take
some
IT period.
Infrastructure is in place and can link in with the European infrastructure, and you're happy about forgeries and fraud and all the rest?
We will have a number of weeks now to make sure it's absolutely operational, and Europe recognises that. That's why they've given countries an additional 6 weeks after the 1st of July to get it operational. But any delay in airports can always lead to backlogs, and so we're going to have to manage that. We've seen in the UK in Heathrow, when they reintroducing some flights, that they immediately had large queues in the airports. We have to try and avoid that. That will be difficult to manage. And so the interim period between now and that period in July when we reopen, we're going to have to do a lot of work trying to minimise that level of disruption. But there will be disruption, because we still will implement public health measures to check, to make sure that we are checking people as they come in.
Dalton Phillips from the Dublin Airport Authority was on Primetime last night. Like, you've heard the criticism from the aviation sector, and it's quite scathing. He wants the reopening of the common travel area with the UK in June, Europe in July, and the US in August. Is that in prospect?
It was interesting, in the analysis that was presented to us last night, the whole range of public health advice, which is what we have followed first and foremost, but there was also detailed research done of the Irish public, what was their assessment of the speed of the opening up of restrictions. And it's not, you know, it's not the be all and end all, but this is what the Irish people said. About 54% of people said they thought the speed was about right. 24% said they thought it was a bit too slow, and 3% thought it was a bit too fast. It's impossible to get exactly this right. It's not a science, but I think.
But
the Irish
what's happening to the common travel area? Because I mean, that's a third of our airline traffic, isn't it?
The mechanisms, the methods we'll use, will have to provide for travel from the US, from the UK, as well as from Europe. But we do have to take into account different situations. Like, for example, in the coming days, I expect a number of the countries that had been on what they called the deep red list.
France, will be taken, Belgium, Luxembourg.
Those sort of countries will be taken off it, because what we always said was those were temporary measures. If there is areas of concern, particularly around variant, then we will still have to be vigilant, and we'll have to keep an eye, particularly on the likes of more transmissible variants.
So but what does that mean? Because we're in a situation at the moment where, you know, at the moment, if I want to go to the UK, I can just go there. If I'm coming from the UK, I'm supposed to do my test and all the rest and follow that procedure. But I can hop up to Belfast and hop in. So how do you control the Indian variant coming in, and how do you open up the common travel area, and what's your plan in that regard?
It has always been one of the real difficulties in our situation, is that we do have an open border with Northern Ireland. We're not going to close that. We have seen an ability to contain the Indian variant here. It's about, again, from the evidence last night, roughly it's about 6-7% of overall incidents now in Ireland are that variant. In the UK, it's higher, probably 50% plus or more. So we do have to be careful.
It's now the dominant variant, and people who are vaccinated are ending up in hospital.
Well, the evidence that we were again presented yesterday, and this is the latest evidence from our public health advisors, is the vaccines are working, and actually they may work for a slightly longer period. There was some concern as to how long they would have their efficacy. The evidence increasingly is showing that the vaccines work, that a combination of them can work, and that the length of their strength is actually improving. So
what's your plan for connectivity to the UK in June then?
Again, we're going to have to wait for Cabinet to sign off on the various measures. But the UK, along with the European Union and US and other countries, particularly those where we can show it isn't, we don't have to have an emergency break. We will still have that emergency break for areas or countries where there's high issues of variants. And yes, we will see return to traffic in a way that is part of the overall normalisation going back to
and
normal
life. And finally,
life.
Just on that, because this is the big cry from the aviation sector. They want to see a plan. They're worried about airlines that used to be based in Dublin. They're being wooed by other cities, other destinations. They're worried that the US will open up for transatlantic travel to the UK first and we could be at a disadvantage.
And what we always said, and we shared those worries, we always said, and I've been talking to them right through this whole crisis, what they wanted more than anything else, by the end of May, and we agreed this, is that we would set a date when that reopening would come. We will do that later today.
Transport Minister Eamon Ryan, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland.
July 19th, that's the proposed date being considered for the easing of international travel restrictions. COVID is the worst thing to have ever happened to the aviation industry, but there is hope on the horizon, according to Kieran O'Brien from KPMG, the lead advisory partner in aviation, finance. Kieran, you spoke at a guaranteed Irish event on professional services yesterday, and you said that the aviation sector is resilient. Where are you seeing signs of recovery?
Thanks, Julian. Good morning. I think we're seeing signs of recovery, certainly in other jurisdictions, which is very positive, and I think it'd be very hopeful for us. I think if you look at the UK, on May 7th, they announced a green list where people could come back, say, from travel without quarantining. And in actual fact, the bookings for those that after that was announced are actually up 40% in the same time, 2019. So it's an increase in the average from that point. So clearly there's a pent-up demand for certainly leisure travel. And I think what we're seeing actually is that they will clearly, people will look and are looking to return to travel. There's such a clamouring to do that. I think, look, it's usually positive that the minister is indicating that we'll certainly have a date and an order to reopen with international travel. Look, really positive from that perspective.
Dalton Phillips of the DAA said Ireland is the most disconnected country in the EU, and we heard Áine put the question to the minister in relation to other airlines being wooed elsewhere. Will a recovery in Irish aviation take longer than elsewhere?
No, I don't think so. I think the reality is that, look, clearly it's a very competitive sector and it's a strategically important sector to every country, and having large airlines in place is usually beneficial for the economy in terms of jobs and connectivity. But we have to remember that Ireland has always been a leader in aviation, be it airlines, be it leasing, be it loads of the supply chain. And I'd be very positive that the skills and capability and experience will continue to the fore over the next number of years. And certainly there'll be changes and there'll be a restructuring in the sector. But I do think that the skills experience will ultimately win out. We're a very innovative nation in aviation and that will continue.
A number of startup airlines have registered in Europe. How many? And is now a good time to start up an airline?
Yeah. So, on research done by the IBA, they're saying about 130, which I think is hugely interesting. And look, if you're a new startup and you don't have legacy debt or any issues, then clearly it's a good time. And I think we've always seen people start airlines, but it's a huge number. The reality is, it's probably a positive time. But we have to remember that in a number of years' time, you know, we will see the large airlines back, the more established airlines back coming in, and that will change the cost structure. So it's unlikely 130 will still be here in a number of years' time, but clearly we'll have new players being really successful, which will change the market and make it more competitive. But I think that's a good thing for the consumer in the long run.
On a separate issue, we heard from Minister for Transport Eamon Ryan about the International Aviation Civil Aviation Organisation launching an investigation into the forced landing of the Ryanair flight last week. What are the cost implications to airlines of having to fly around a very large airspace?
I think that's twofold. I think clearly it's a challenge, right? And it will increase cost and travel times. But the reality is safety of everybody has to come first. And it's always something that's hugely important within the sector. So I think it's unfortunate, but I think we do need to really look, consider the safety of passengers. And I think the EU response and the strong response is good and absolutely essential. We must protect everybody and their rights in the skies.
We'll leave it there. Kieran O'Brien, lead advisory partner in aviation finance with KPMG.
Vaccine shortfall will not delay plans for reopening is the lead headline for the Irish Times this morning. Above detail that significant shortfalls in supply are not expected to affect the new schedule for reopening of social and economic life to be announced today. And there's plenty of detail of what's expected to be announced later in the papers this morning. Matches, concerts and outdoor gigs from June 7th is the main story for the Irish Examiner, which says that in a surprise move, NPHET has recommended that some measures be eased earlier than expected, allowing for the resumption of outdoor events for up to 100 people or 200 in larger stadia from the first week in June. And we're told cinemas have also been added to the June 7th reopening list. Today's expected announcement on indoor dining is flagged on the front of the Irish Daily Star, and the Irish Daily Mail's front page declares summer kicks off and lists off the top line details of what's planned to be announced. Reopening is on the front page of the Irish Independent too this morning, and that paper's editorial takes into account the latest news on the vaccine shortfalls and the expected relaxation of restrictions, writing that opposition frontbenchers and coalition backbenchers alike have the luxury of forgetting everything they said before and coming out with top-of-the-head theories. The leader writer concludes that the Cabinet would be well advised to err on the side of caution. It would be better to be conservative than to be caught out again. Elsewhere on the front page of the Irish Times, Mark Paul has the story that hair salons say the pandemic unemployment payment and black market nixers for hairdressing are causing a staffing crisis, and that the Hairdressing Council of Ireland wants action on what it characterises as the shadow economy. Rent trap, tenants face double hike in prices as freeze ends, is Fionnán Sheehan's front page lead story for the Irish Independent this morning. He writes that tenants are facing a double rent hike this summer when the freeze on prices is lifted. Landlords in rent pressure zones will be able to apply a double increase from July. This means that the national rent can go up by 100 per month and 140 in Dublin, as a loophole allows hikes for 2 years in one go. And on page two of the Examiner, Elaine Loughlin writes that the Dáil heard yesterday that more than 140 rented properties in just one area of Cork are not registered with the Residential Tenancies Board, leaving tenants unprotected. The ratification of Edwin Poots as leader of the DUP is big news for the Belfast Telegraph and the Irish News this morning. The two papers report that outgoing leader Arlene Foster and leadership rival Geoffrey Donaldson both left last night's confirmation meeting before the new leader addressed his party, with Gareth Cross reporting in the Telegraph that Mrs. Foster made a peace sign as she departed. And elsewhere on the Irish News front page, the story that the TV doctor Christian Jessen is facing a legal bill of in excess of £250,000 over his libelous claim that Arlene Foster had an extramarital affair. Yesterday, she was awarded damages of £125,000 by the High Court in Belfast over the defamatory tweet. And on page two of the Irish Times, Sylvia Thompson reports on yesterday's Mind Your Selfie webinar event, which focused on how young people can best prepare themselves for life after lockdown. Paul Gilligan, clinical psychologist and chief executive of St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, had three top tips for people. Firstly, we need to believe that we are loved, that we are good people, and that we have the ability to be happy. Secondly, we have to trust others. This is a reminder, he said, that it's important to express how you feel, listen and communicate with other people you trust. And his third tip, to embrace uncertainty. And
as we've been hearing later on today, the government will announce the latest set of plans to reduce COVID-19 restrictions over the next few months. In a moment, we'll hear from Tánaiste the Leo Varadkar, but first, our reporter, Cian McCormack, has been speaking to businesses in the Midwest about what they want and what they need to hear from government today.
The Lime Tree Theatre and Bell Table are two venues in Limerick City.
It's been quiet at the Lime Tree and Bell Table theatres during the pandemic.
Really, since March 2020, we got to open the Bell Table for 6 weeks, and that's been it.
The two venues are part of the Lime Tree Theatre Company. Its director, Louise Donlan, is hoping for a clearer picture about what will happen as restrictions ease.
Well, the key issue for us is the restrictions on capacity. A 510-seat venue with everybody at 2 metre distance has the capacity of 100. Similarly, in the Bell Table, our capacity will only be 45. And that essentially makes it unviable, both for the venues and for the theatre companies and the promoters bringing work into the venue. I suppose we're expecting that there will be continued reduced restrictions when we're allowed open, and we don't have a problem with that. Really, it's all about planning right now, and we need to know what the thinking is in terms of reducing the restrictions over a long period of time, over, say, between now and Christmas.
Ronan Branigan, Managing Director of the Savoy Collection, which includes two hotels and four restaurants in Limerick, hopes to hear more detail about indoor dining.
We want, firstly, clarity. We want to know things like indoor dining, you know, when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. We also need things like the supports that are in place at the moment, the EWSS and the CRSS, which supports businesses that have been the worst hit, i.e. hospitality, restaurants, hotels, bars, cafes, guest houses, that all of those supports do not fall off a cliff edge and that they are there for some period to come and will be tapered off very much in keeping with the economic situation at the time.
As restrictions ease, another challenge for Ronan Branigan is hiring staff.
It's a dance at the moment. Many staff had returned to their home country, and the PUP payment of €350 is also, I suppose, a disincentive at this point as we approach, you know, getting people back to work.
He adds, foreign travel needs to reopen.
Well, I would call on government to work with the EU's traffic light system for countries with lower infection rates to get travel moving again into and out of Ireland, and to make sure that the economic and financial supports are in place for Shannon and Cork to flourish, not only in the very, very short term, but over the coming years.
Eugene Garrahy, the owner of Doolin to Aran Ferries and Dublin Bay Cruises, holds a similar view on foreign travel.
This year, tourism, I think, will be similar to last year in Ireland. It will be staycationers. I would be much more worried about, you know, after the autumn or autumn and onwards into next year. I hope the European policy of the green card or whatever title they have on it, I hope Ireland adopts that swiftly and that we move on as quickly as possible so that people that sell Ireland abroad in the States and Tourism Ireland are allowed to do that with certainty.
For travel agent Jeff Collins, managing director of Best for Travel, which runs Creation Travel in Limerick, getting international travel open again will resuscitate his business, and he's looking for specific reopening dates from government.
Our business has been totally closed for the last 15 months. We're on a life support machine and we need the help to open up so we can start trading again and start breathing life into our industry. I feel, and this is my own opinion, that, you know, give time for the people to be vaccinated, give the HSE the time to finish the vaccinations, but then let international travel open, but have a date for it to be open from.
And when, not, when do you think that date should be?
Well, realistically, you know, I feel that sometime in August will be fair.
And that's Jeff Collins there, the managing director of Best for Travel, which runs Creation Travel in Limerick, ending that report by Cian McCormack. Tánaiste Leo Varadkar, good morning to you.
Morning.
People want clarity. They want to know what your thinking is in reducing restrictions. You said in the Dáil yesterday that we're well ahead of ourselves in terms of the hospitalisations and the cases. We have about 100 hospitalisations, around 40 in ICU and up to 400 cases on any given day. So are they the measurements? Are they what are now underpinning the decisions you're making around the lifting of restrictions?
Yeah, that's right. Cases are stable around 400 or 500 a day and have been for quite some time, even though restrictions have been eased quite a lot. Numbers in ICU well below 50. Interestingly, when you look at the cases, only about 2% of new cases are people over 65. And less than 2% of new cases are healthcare workers. So that just shows how effective the vaccines are. They are a miracle of science and enterprise, and they are the way out of this. And the vaccine program, even though we are running into supply difficulties, is pretty much where we thought it would be at this point in time. So that gives us the confidence, based on advice from NPHET, to ease restrictions. Cabinet COVID Committee met last night, met with the CMO, head of the HSC, Professor Bree McCraw as well, heads of the vaccine programme, came up with some recommendations, and we will bring those recommendations to Cabinet this afternoon, and the Taoiseach will make a full announcement then around 6 o'clock this evening.
Are you well ahead on the vaccine programme? Because are you accepting now that the vaccine targets that were set for the end of June, that's for over 80% to have received at least a first vaccination, those targets will not be met?
Yeah, the target was that by the end of June, 82% of people would be offered a vaccine. As Taoiseach and Mr. Donnelly always said at the time, that was contingent on supplies. And we do know now that it's very likely that once again AstraZeneca and also on this occasion Janssen aren't going to be able to deliver the supplies that they're
contracted
to. Huge
cut in the Janssen promise.
Yeah, and that will have an impact. But even still, you know, we would still expect to be in the mid-70s in terms of the percentage of people who've received one or both vaccines by the end of June. And we'll be able to make that up at some point in July. And speaking to Professor McGrath yesterday, we now expect that by the end of July, 2.5 million people will be fully vaccinated. That's more than 60% of the adult population fully vaccinated by the end of July. So behind, because of factors outside of our control, but not so far behind that would cause us to change any decisions today.
So will it have? Is it having any impact on the decisions that you're making in terms of timelines on lifting restrictions then?
It's not having an impact in terms of the decisions that we're going to make today around easing restrictions here within Ireland. It is something we do need to bear in mind in relation to international travel. Because we all want to return to international travel. You know, we want to see our friends and family abroad. We want to welcome tourists back to Ireland. We want to give people who work in aviation hope for the future. But the real thing we want to avoid is a repeat of what happened in December, which was increased socialisation combined with a new, more infectious variant that came in as a consequence of international travel, causing a new wave of infection. And that is a risk, and we're aware that that's a risk as a government. The difference now is vaccines. We didn't have the vaccines then, we do. But every week that passes, 300,000 more people are either vaccinated or fully vaccinated. And that's why we're not going to be the first country in the European Union to open up international travel, because every extra week is 300,000 more people protected. And that's why it makes sense to wait until a little bit longer before we give the green light to international
travel. All right, before we get into even further detail on international travel, and I do want to, because people want to know, let's stay with hospitality. Hotels opening on the 2nd of June, outdoor restaurants, pubs from the 7th of June. We are told indoor from the 5th of July. You haven't confirmed that date to us. Maybe you can. But the Restaurant Association is saying it will challenge this decision to allow indoor dining in hotels from June the 2nd, which is well ahead of the plan for the restaurants and gastro pubs. And they say it's based on zero scientific or medical evidence. What is that decision based on?
Yeah, the decision in relation to hotels really is more of a practical one than a scientific one. You know, hotels have always been able to serve meals to their guests. Even during the worst period of the pandemic in level five, hotels were able to provide meals in the dining room for their guests. We never required them to eat in their rooms, and we're not going to change that now. But one thing that, you know, I strongly advocated for as Minister for Business, and I think the decision today will be on these lines, is that the gap between indoor dining and outdoor dining will not be big. It's only going to be a matter of a few weeks. So outdoor dining will be allowed first. As you know, that's going to happen on the 7th of June. We'll agree a date in early July today to allow indoor.
I know, but where's the fairness in that, Minister? If it's not, as you say, based on any scientific advice, where is the fairness in allowing hotels to open up back in full production, back in business?
Yeah.
And pubs, you know, many of them have not reopened since this pandemic started.
And they will, which is going to be great to see the pubs open.
Still curtailed, you know, for yet another month.
Yeah, so there is very clear scientific evidence that outdoor is much safer than indoor. The disparity, I suppose, is that a difference is being made for hotels. How are we going to correct that and compensate for that? We're going to continue to pay the CRIS payment. That's the weekly payment for businesses that are closed. We're going to continue to pay that to restaurants and pubs, even when they open outdoors. So hopefully that'll help a bit for those few weeks. It's only a few weeks of a gap between
outdoors and indoors.
What is it about
if it's from the 7th of June on to the 5th of July? So it's a month.
Well, Cabinet will make a decision on that later on today. But what I can, you know, say to you is that in what's intended is in the first week of July, there'll be a major set of reopenings, and that'll be mostly linked to indoor activities and indoor and indoor services. So it's going to be an outdoor summer, but not outdoors only. And then in the first week of August, a further set of easing of restrictions. But again, these are cabinet decisions yet to be made.
We heard from the Bell Table in Limerick, and people are excited at the idea that there might be outdoor and indeed indoor gigs again, that people will be able to return as spectators to sporting events. But what sort of precautions will be put in place around that? Will people, for example, have to be fully vaccinated? Will they have to have antigen tests? What procedures are you considering around that?
Yeah, certainly when it comes to vaccination, we're not going to make that a requirement to attend, you know, any event or any service or receive any service in Ireland. That'll be just for international travel. So
just to be clear, are you saying no vaccination necessary to, for example, go to a club match or hopefully to attend a music gig?
Yeah, that's correct. So the safety will be based on, you know, standard public health precautions, good hygiene, social distancing and limiting numbers. There are going to be quite a number of pilot events, though. Mm-hmm. Pilot events that would see, you know, pretty large numbers being allowed to gather outdoors and in some cases indoors. And we've yet to work out the detail of that, and potentially testing might be part of the
antigen
protocol
testing
for that.
Or PCR testing?
Most likely antigen testing for the pilot events, but again, that has to be worked out. But the pilot events are separate to what's going to be announced, if you like, for early July and early August. So in July and August, without any requirement of a vaccine or any requirement of a test, people will be able to attend sporting events. They will be able to attend musical and cultural events outdoors. So, you know, you are going to see a return to that. But there may be some much bigger events, if that makes any sense.
And we're hearing up to 25% of the capacity of a venue.
Again, the details, there will be lots of details, a very clear roadmap, but you'll have to wait later today before it's confirmed.
Does that sound about right, though?
Sounds about right.
That sounds about right. Let's come back to international travel. Are you now saying to people, and I know I've asked you this question before, but are you now saying to people who want to book a sun holiday, go ahead, you're safe enough booking for the latter half of July into August?
Well, like I said, the date will be confirmed later on today, but it is going to mean a phased return to international travel, which I think is going to be very welcome for lots of different reasons. But it's not going to be international travel as you knew it. You know, there are going to be restrictions, requirements around vaccines and testing, for example. And we will be back to a situation whereby there are different rules for different countries. So we're buying into the European Digital Green Cert system. So there will be a different set of rules for EU countries versus non-EU countries. And there will still be countries that are on a danger list or a red list where the restrictions will be very tough.
So the mandatory quarantining will continue for red list countries, but you are taking some European countries off that list?
Well, all EU countries are coming off.
All of them
the mandatory hotel quarantine list. But like I say, it's great that we're going to see a return to international travel, but we're going to try and do it as safely as possible and minimise risk. And that, unfortunately, will create a degree of uncertainty for some people because, you know, you might book a trip somewhere for a country that's not on a red list, but it may be on the red list by the time you go there. And there will be requirements around vaccines and testing. So, unfortunately, it's not going to be a return to international travel as we used to know it, at least not yet, but it is going to be a clear roadmap and a phased return to international travel, which I hope.
Are you going to restore the common travel area with the UK? Dalton Phillips has been talked about in other interviews this morning from the Dublin Airport Authority. He'd like to see it back from June.
Yeah, and I would have too. But the advice that we have, and we're accepting this advice from NEFID, is that there are real concerns about the prevalence of the Indian variant in Britain. It's now the dominant variant in Britain. Over 50% of cases appear to be this B1617 variant. That's something we're concerned about. And for that reason, we're not in a position to restore the common travel area just yet.
Does that mean, though, Tánaiste, that while international travel, particularly with the European Digital Passport, will be up and running from mid-late July, that the common travel area might still be subject to conditions for people travelling back into this country from the UK?
From Britain, yes. Not from Northern Ireland. There will continue to be restrictions, you know, for example, requirements to have a vaccine, perhaps requirements to
despite
to be
the
tested.
Fact that people can fly into Belfast and drive on down.
That's always been a difficulty when it comes to travel restrictions for us. But I think people will understand that we do have a real concern about that B1617 variant. Now, it might turn out okay, you know, notwithstanding the fact that it's now the dominant variant in Britain.
Do you expect a fourth wave? Because a lot of the scientific experts say it's not a question of if, but when.
But it's also a question of how big a wave and what impact that has on hospitalizations and on deaths. And what is very encouraging is that even with that variant being very strong now in Britain, they're not seeing a huge increase in hospitalizations and deaths because the vaccines are effective. And that's one thing we're increasingly confident of, is that the vaccines, particularly when you're fully vaccinated, they are effective against all variants. The difficulty we have is that there are still a lot of people in Ireland not vaccinated. And that's why we're going to be relatively cautious with international travel. Like I say, every week we delay, 300,000 more people are either vaccinated or fully vaccinated. So, you know, just waiting a month, that's 1.2 million more vaccines. And I think people understand the sense behind that.
All right. Tánaiste Leo Varadkar, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. And further announcements on the lifting of those restrictions expected during the course of the day.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 22 minutes to 9, more sports news. Here's Des.
Yeah, and lots of good news on you because, of course, we understand the spectators look set to be allowed to return to outdoor sporting events from June the 7th. But I understand that potential attendances could be greater than were originally predicted and anticipated. This follows reports of the recommendation by NPHET to the Cabinet COVID Committee. And, of course, that will be discussed by Cabinet today. But I understand rather than up to 5,000 people, it could grow significantly stronger and there could be as many as 10,000 at the Leinster Hurling Final, which would be the first increase, and possibly more than 20,000 at the All-Ireland Finals in August. But that, of course, will depend on the announcement, as we're aware of, coming from the government later today. But my understanding is the potential figures could be greater than originally predicted. Now, it's going to be an emotional evening at Thomond Park, sadly without fans, because I know so many Munster fans would love to be there to pay their tributes to CJ Stander, Tommy O'Donnell and James Cronin, who make their final appearance for the province in their last home game of the season as they take on Cardiff in the Rainbow Cup. Stander and O'Donnell are retiring while Cronin is leaving Munster. Ulster's game against Scarlets tomorrow, meanwhile, has been cancelled as four Ulster players have tested positive for COVID-19. Meanwhile, the Kilkenny-Wexford Hurling League game has not yet been given the go-ahead for Sunday, but that is expected to be confirmed later today. It was postponed last week because Wexford had three players with COVID, and yesterday Kilkenny reported that one of their players had tested positive, but it's believed that that case arose in a non-team context and officials are confident all further tests will be negative. But of course, football dominates the GAA landscape this weekend. Virtually every game impacts on promotion or relegation, and Tomás O'Shea really likes this system of small four-team leagues.
I do, Des, even though the divisions are split in two. The old system would have had it that the top two teams go straight up and the bottom two teams just go down. So the last day might be have a few boring matches. But in this format, there's matches to be played, important games to be played until the very, very last day. Because even if you end up at the bottom of the table, you still have a chance of playing the bottom group above and you could have a chance of survival. I think it's very good. I think it's brilliant in the fact that you're coming up towards championship and you have a championship style match towards the end where you have to win to stay up. It's very, very important for certain teams to get up to Division 1, to stay in Division 2, to get up from Division 3. So those games will all come into play in the next week or two. So it is brilliant and I do think, yes, the COVID came in and we had to change it up, but it is very important. And if you look across the divisions, there's something to play for in every one again. It's the one competition, the championship, so many teams drop out so early, but everybody still has a say and something realistic to fight for towards the end of the league. And it's absolutely brilliant. You look at Division 1 up north with all the northern teams, it's very hard to call. Roscommon and Galway seem to be trouble in Division 1 south. You go to Division 2, Mayo and Meath have won everything. Down and Westmeath are down, but they're still not out, and that's the key here. Colm Collins is doing absolutely brilliant with Clare. They're nearly up to Division 1, and Cork have to beat them to actually make sure that they're not in the relegation playoff. So there's games to be played all over the place. You have Mickey Hart and Tony McEntee going at each other and having to win to survive in Division 4 and to try to get promotion. And Division 3, you have Derry going absolutely brilliant under Rory Gallagher. Cavan having to beat them this week to make sure that they're in the safe for promotion. So if you look anywhere across the divisions, even in Division 4, Des, if Wexford win, they're all on level points and it'll actually go to score difference. So there's something to play for in every division. And if you look at it, I do think it's a better format in terms of the last format. The last format, there was a big gap between league and championship, and also there was dead ducks on the last day. Whereas this, I think, the penultimate round, the last round of the league, but then you're going to have the relegations and you're going to have the promotion playoffs, and that's the big difference this year, and that's why I like it.
Great stuff. Thanks, Tomás. Now in soccer, the league leaders Sligo Rovers face a tricky game this evening. They go to Finn Harps. St Patrick's Athletic host Dundalk and Drogheda entertain Derry City. The top game in Division 1 sees the leaders Shelburne host Galway United. But the main game of the weekend, of course, is tomorrow evening, the All-English Champions League final, as Manchester City take on Chelsea in Porto. And joining us to look ahead to it now is George Hamilton. Good morning, George.
Morning, Des.
Two attacking teams, but finals are so often cagey affairs. What do you expect of this one?
Well, I would expect a caginess certainly from Chelsea because they know what they're up against. They have beaten Manchester City twice in recent times, but against that, they know how dangerous Manchester City can be. And Chelsea, who's rebuilding under Thomas Tuchel, you could describe as a work in progress, has depended on a well-resourced defence and hitting teams on the counter. So I would expect a relative caginess from Chelsea. It's nonetheless employing the high press. But Manchester City, with Kevin De Bruyne in the side, have got the man with the killer pass. And in Riyad Mahrez, they have the man in form. So I think the scales tilt slightly towards Manchester City, who also, of course, have the hottest talent in English football, Phil Foden, who turns 21 today. What a birthday present it would be for him if they could win.
Indeed it would. Chelsea have beaten Manchester City twice this season. Pep Guardiola doesn't seem to read much into that.
No, I think previous performances don't necessarily mean anything. If football was decided on the past, Chelsea wouldn't have a hope because of the way their season has ended, concluding defeat in the FA Cup final. So I think it's all on the night and it's all how it plays out. And you saw against Paris Saint-Germain, how Manchester City began cagily until they saw that they had the beating of Paris Saint-Germain, and then they cut loose. And I think it'll be something the same in tomorrow night's final. The only thing that City need to guard against, I think, is Pep Guardiola's tendency to overthink matches. When you realise that Chelsea have won the Champions League more recently than Pep Guardiola. They won it in 2012 when they won in Bayern Munich. Barcelona under Guardiola, with a defining performance at Wembley the previous year and beating Manchester United, that is Guardiola's most recent Champions League success in 2011. And I think that might be playing on his mind just a little bit, and there may be just the little opening that Thomas Tuchel and Chelsea can exploit. A doubt, you know, you don't look at Guardiola and the word doubt doesn't enter your head. But when you look at that statistic, 10 years since he's won it, maybe there's the way for Chelsea.
All right, okay. Thank you for that, George Hamilton. In golf news, Leona Maguire went close to sealing her place in the knockout stages of the LPGA match play in Las Vegas. The Cavan woman led her match with world number 17, Jennifer Kupcho, all the way, but the American reeled her in to force a half on the final hole. So both players now have 1.5 points from two games. Maguire faces Christina Kim in the final group match today. On the European Tour in Denmark, Down's Jonathan Caldwell is on 4 under after his opening 6 holes today, but that's now 4 shots off the lead because Bernd Wiesberg has picked up 3 shots this morning to move to 8 under. On the PGA Tour, Jordan Spieth and Sergio Garcia lead the Charles Schwab Challenge on 7 under par. Graham McDowell way back on 4 over. In cycling, Nicholas Roach battled bravely to finish 3rd on yesterday's tough stage of the Giro d'Italia. Italy's Alberto Bettiol took stage honours. Race leader Egan Bernal retains his advantage of 2 minutes 21 seconds. Dan Martin remains 10th overall. And in racing, yet another good day for Henry de Bromhead yesterday. He won the Group 2 Henry II Stakes at Sandown and also had a double at Limerick. And today's racing action is at Ferry House with the first race at 1:15.
Second level schools are closing this week for the summer during what was a difficult and disrupted school year. Much has been said about the plight of Leaving Certificate students, but of course all students have missed out, and some schools say they're especially concerned now for those middle students in third and fourth year. Some of those students, both urban and rural, have been talking to our education correspondent Emma O'Kelly about their concerns and experiences in this report.
The sun is shining and transition year students are playing rounders in the yard of Our Lady of Mercy Secondary School when I arrive. This perfect scene belies the year these students have had. They've missed the normal things that TY should be all about. The class trips, the work experience, and on top of that, they had no junior cert exams last year. Here's TY students Libby Landers and Robin Rogers.
Online work was really hard because it wasn't interacting with teachers, it wasn't one-on-one. Like in school, you're allowed, if you have them, they come over. If you see them crossing the hall, it wasn't like that.
In TY, you look forward to a lot of stuff such as trips and activities, and we had a trip organised for, I think it was before Christmas, to go to Glendalough, and that's sort of our bonding experience for the year. And that got cancelled, obviously, so we didn't have one of them. And then we had obviously our 3 months off.
Well, the worst fears were, I suppose, that the students who were on the school completion targeted lists of being at risk of early school leaving, that they would not come back to us.
Pory Gibbons is principal at Our Lady of Mercy Secondary School. He says that thankfully those worst fears have not come to pass, but there's still danger ahead.
For a student who may come from a background with not a lot of support or who may come from a difficult background, this is their safe place, essentially. And this is where they are free to express themselves and free to learn and to feel safe. We would have concerns in terms of how the current transition years, the current third years and the current fifth years in particular will come back to us in September. There was a huge engagement in the online teaching. Every teacher did their best, every student did their best, but it is not the same. That needs to be recognised as a face-to-face teaching that could take place.
Back with the TYs, Ryan Merriman explains the challenge he faced during the school closures.
I just found it hard, like, being motivated to get up in the morning and be like, online school. Because when you're going to school, you're like, have to get dressed and go to school, but online, you can't really do any of that. And it's just the atmosphere at home isn't the same as in school as well, you know. You're trying to tell you, sit in your bed or just do nothing, you know.
Ryan's biggest concern is about the fact that he didn't get to sit his junior cert exams.
Like in third year, everyone was like, thank God we didn't have the junior cert. But now looking at it, I don't think any of us know where we are for education. So if someone said, you want to do the junior cert, I'd say yeah.
Classmates of Ryan's, like Kimberly Coker, nod assiduously as he expresses this concern.
Obviously, it's good that we didn't have to do it because there was no stress. But obviously, we don't know what levels we're at.
Far away from Dublin 12 in the Laois countryside, another teenager is musing about the impact of the lockdowns on her education. Georgie Rome is in third year. It may seem odd, but she feels that during lockdown, her horizons actually expanded and she grew.
Through social media and stuff during lockdown, you got to relate to a lot of people and what they were, their situations. There's the platform TikTok and the Black Lives Matter protest, I think that was a big part of TikTok for a while.
You feel you've matured?
I have, yeah. I'd forgotten what it's like to do nothing and not have training in the evening or have to finish my homework then just go to bed and wake up and do school all over again. I got to take time out and think.
So what lies ahead for the second level system's middle children, this year's junior cert and TY years? After the summer, there's some serious catching up to be done, as Pory Gibbons explains.
Third year is going into transition year. It will be much more of a structured academic approach. So the basics of your English, your Irish, your maths, your literacy, your numeracy, they can be caught up on to bridge that gap. In terms of transition year going into fifth year, again, there will be almost like a boot camp.
And what do Porrig's students make of that?
How do you feel about that? Yeah, boot camp?
Not good, no.
You missed half of our education in Georgia.
So going into fifth year now, you're going to have to put your head down. You're going to have to work really hard to get the grades that you want.
Well, enjoy the summer holidays. That was Emma O'Kelly reporting there.